Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Oh, good morning. We are back in the studio today after a really, really fun live broadcast yesterday of the show. What a blast. I had so much fun. I was so excited yesterday after the event. I was not able to take either of my two naps yesterday, but it was so, so much fun. Thanks to all of our guests that came and made the event so much fun. I want to start the day just by saying, Barbara Bush has died at age 92. You probably have heard of that by now. But here's a clip from a speech she gave at Wellesley College in 1998, and there's a line from it I want you to hear.
Whether you're talking about education, career, or service, you're talking about life, and life really must have joy. It's supposed to be fun.
I love that attitude. That's kind of how I feel. And I think of what Jesus says in John chapter 16. He says, I've told you these things that you may have peace. In this world, you will have trouble. But be of good cheer. I've overcome the world. I think how often are Christians characterized as people of good cheer? And we probably need to work at that a little bit every day. And last night I did stay up and watch my Minnesota Wild hockey team play. And they lost. And they play again Friday night in Winnipeg, and if they lose, their season is over. And all I have to say to them is this. Good and morning. It's 7 minutes after the hour. Vernon Brewer is the CEO and founder of World Help. World Help is a Christian humanitarian organization committed to serving the physical and spiritual needs of people in impoverished communities around the world. Since its inception, from the very beginning in 1991, World Help has delivered humanitarian aid to more than, ready for this, 82 million people in 70 countries. This is a person who's getting some things done. And he's on our studio line this morning. Good morning, Vernon.
Hey, Bill. Good to be with you.
Good to be you. Where are you from, Vernon?
I'm in Lynchburg, Virginia.
Okay. And what an ambitious project God laid on your heart to do what you're doing.
Well, it's just absolutely tragic what's happening in Syria. And we can't sit back and do nothing in the face of such evil. So, yes, we're trying our best to make a difference.
Yeah. Vernon, let me quote Stephen O'Brien, who's a UN Emergency Relief Coordinator. He said, "The Syrian civil war is a complete meltdown of humanity, the apex of horror." That's pretty strong words.
Well, when you consider that the government in Syria has used chemical warfare on their own people not once but multiple times, and that these you see the horrific photos on television of people that are eyes are watering and they're gasping for air, and you see the pictures of them trying to wash the chemicals off of babies and young children, and you see the devastation that they're doing to their own people, and you realize this is pure evil.
Mm, it is. Now, the Syrian civil war, that began about 7 years ago, didn't it?
Yeah, 7 years ago, last month, I believe.
Okay.
It started with just a series of demonstrations, and the government reacted so negatively that it has escalated into full-scale war.
Wow.
More than 400,000 people have been killed and or missing, and 13 million, Bill, have been forced from their homes. Their homes have been destroyed. Many of them, their cities have been destroyed. They have nothing to go back to. So imagine more than half the population of Syria is homeless, living in tents, living on the street. It's just a disaster.
Vernon, it just breaks my heart. I don't even know how to put my arms around this.
Well, someone asked Mother Teresa one time, Bill, how can you end poverty? And her response was one person at a time. And World Help has partners, Syrian Christians, on the ground, both in Damascus and in other nearby countries that shall remain nameless. And we have a pipeline of goods and containers going in that are being distributed by Christians with food and medicine and baby formula and clothes and everything they need for survival. And we're trying to get as much of this life-saving aid to these refugees as possible. And Bill, for only $35, you can provide enough food and medicine and clothes for one refugee for more than a week.
So we're
trying to rally the troops, rally the Christians here in America, so that we do more than just have pity or do more than just feeling sorry for someone, but let's do something about this situation one person at a time.
Vernon, I agree. Okay, Eastern Hauta has been in the news quite a bit lately. What is going on there? Can you give us an understanding of what's happening there?
Well, you know, that was kind of Assad's last stand, Bill. Just a few days ago, at least 70 people, many of them women and children, as you know, suffocated to death on the chemical attack on Douma, which is just right outside of Damascus and part of that eastern Ghouta region. And more than 500 people required medical treatment. And Douma and eastern Ghouta are these suburbs of Damascus. This is their last stand. The moderate rebel forces, once the chemical warfare began, the rebels surrendered, which was what Assad wanted to happen. And so this whole region has just been almost utterly destroyed.
Mm-hmm. I want to say, Vernon, and maybe you can help me with these facts, but in the last 30 days or so, nearly 1,500 people have died, close to 300 of them, which were small kids, children.
Yes, that's correct. And many of them babies and toddlers. Mm. And then nearly 100 of them died because of the sarin gas nerve agent and the chemicals that were used.
It takes my breath away. It just is so hard to put my arms around this. So I'm sorry, I'm a little bit at a loss for words right now. But, I mean, that is going on right now, and it's just it's so hard to believe.
Well, I would hope your listeners would feel the same way as you and I do. I think it's good to have our hearts broken occasionally. I think God does that. I think it's much better than the alternative of having a hard heart. And, you know, we are trying to be the hands and feet of Jesus on the ground. And our World Help teams and our World Help partners, our Syrian partners, we're delivering life-saving aid. We're also delivering the love of Jesus Christ and showing the love of Jesus Christ. And many Muslims are coming to faith not because of evangelistic outreaches, but they're coming to faith because they're seeing the love of Christ in action.
Yeah.
And they're seeing that in the face of evil and when their own government is trying to destroy them, they see that someone cares and they see the love of Jesus, and that attraction draws them to the faith. And that's why at World Help, we're trying to get as many people as possible to help be part of the solution. And for only $35, we can save a life.
Mm-hmm. Vernon, let me take a little break. When I come back, I want to hear more about the I know there's a humanitarian crisis there and what is being done about it. We'll keep that conversation going with Vernon Brewer in just a minute. It's 15 minutes after the hour. Thanks for being with me. Thanks for being with me this morning. It's 18 minutes after the hour. As you're getting your day started and getting the coffee brewed, I just want to say this is a difficult conversation I'm having with Vernon Brewer, only because of the Syrian refugee crisis is so hard to, it's so hard to understand and grasp and try to get in the shoes of the people that are in so much distress. And Vernon, I'd like you to talk about some of the stories that are happening. There's a gentleman named Nasser. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, Nasser was one of the obviously, it's not his real name, but he was one of the refugees whose life was spared after much torture. I was in a refugee camp recently, Bill, and a man came hurrying toward me, yelling in Arabic, carrying his baby in his arms, and he kept pleading with me to do something I couldn't understand. And when he finally reached me, he began to say the same words over and over, and I quickly learned that his didn't take me long to figure out that his wife had been killed. He'd been trying to keep his three-month-old baby alive. He told me it had been raining. It was cold. It was snowing. He was afraid his baby was dying. And he kept shoving his baby in my arms. He was trying to give her to me to spare her life. Imagine this. This man was trying to give me his own daughter. And I stood there stunned. I said, "Dear God," I said, "this man has nowhere to turn. He would rather give me his daughter and me save her life than to allow her to die." And that was an aha moment for me. You know, in Matthew it says, when Jesus saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion. Well, that was a compassion moment for me, not just feeling pity, but suffering together with someone. And people like this man that tried to give me his baby, and people like Nasser, who had a dream about a refugee camp and a group of people giving him food to keep him alive, and then that dream came true. I believe that God is working in the hearts of many people in the Middle East through dreams to draw them to Christ. And I just think right now, more than ever, forget the political ramifications. As human beings, this is the greatest humanitarian crisis in the world. It's genocide, what is happening in that country. And we must do something. We must be the hands and feet of Jesus on the ground. We can't just sit back and wring our hands and do nothing. And that's why I'm asking your listeners, every $35 they give to World Help, we can supply humanitarian aid that will save a life for at least 1 week. And I'm praying, Bill, that people listening today will be moved with compassion and help us reach out to these men and women and children and help us be the hands and feet of Jesus on the ground. We call it help for today and hope for tomorrow.
All right, Vernon, I'll alert our listeners for that, to do that, and you can do that at worldhelp.net? Is that where we go?
Worldhelp.net, yes.
Worldhelp.net. All right, let me ask you as well, what is the best way to pray for the refugees?
Well, Bill, there are people just like you and I, and so I say, anytime I'm asked that question, I say, we need to pray for them just like we'd pray for our own family if they were in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
If my children and grandchildren had been bombed out of their homes and were facing nerve gas and going through the trauma that these people are going through, I would be urgent in my prayers. And we need to pray that God will provide their physical needs, their food, clothes, pray that they can return to work, pray that they can have their lives rebuilt, their homes rebuilt, pray for their families, pray that they'll have enough food to eat, pray for peace, and pray God bless Syria. This is a test for us as Christians, because I believe that this crisis is not only about Syria, but it's about how we as Christians in America will respond.
Mm-hmm. Just a couple of minutes left, Vernon. I understand that the need is great and the urgency is there. Can you just give us a little understanding how the pipeline works in terms of if we give, how do we know that it's going to be getting to the right people and helping people? Just because it always makes it sound like, ooh, how is my money going to get to help people?
It's a great question, and we take great pains to make sure that not only the money goes where it's supposed to go, but that the aid goes where it's supposed to go. And we do two things. We ship ocean-going containers. We have several ready to go right now. We also purchase food in nearby Lebanon and nearby Jordan, wherever possible, and create more containers and caravans. We have a network of Syrian Christians, longtime friends. I've gone to the area 20 times in the last 7 years and have built these relationships, and we trust these people. These are believers that do what they say they do, and they are risking their lives to get someone food and water and medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have vetted partners who are tried, tested, and true. They're believers, and they're on the very front lines of this battle. So I can promise your listeners that their money will go for what it's supposed to go for.
Mm-hmm. Vernon, thank you so much. I've got worldhelp.net open on my laptop in front of me. I already have my gift in my cart. And when we go to break,
wow,
I'm going to check out and just get it over, and just get it done.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill.
Okay, Vernon. God bless you.
Thank you. God bless you.
Yep. 25 minutes after the hour, we'll take a short break and be back in just a few minutes.
If you're picking up drive-through coffee this morning on your way to work, tell them Bill says hi, and make mine a double. The Early Morning Late Show on Faith Radio.
Good morning, 29 minutes after the hour. I have got my donation complete to World Help for the Syrian refugee relief. That was a gripping interview with Vernon Brewer. Passionate guy. He's doing the real thing, the real work, the hands and feet of Jesus. We all need to be doing that as well in our lives. However we can, whatever God has put in our path to do today, go do it. All right, we'll take a break for news and be back in just a minute.
The church I pastor would never pay for abortions, but we discovered, to our shock, we were. This is Jim Garlow. Unknown to us, in 2014, a California bureaucrat arbitrarily decided every insurance provider would have to pay for the killing of preborn babies in the state of California. A government fiat was forced upon us, period. No one notified us except a very smart attorney who informed me. After months of trying to reason with the Department of Managed Health Care in our state, our church, along with other churches and Christian colleges, entered into a lawsuit so that we would not be forced to pay for dismembering babies in the womb. How is it possible that health care can mean coercion of churches and others to pay for abortions? This is not health care. That's health destruction. When we're no longer free to make choices for ourselves, when someone else mandates where we spend our money, that's called bondage. Stay informed at jimgarlow.com.
Good morning, 25 minutes until the top of the hour. That music, of course, belongs to Dr. Ken Kaiser, chair of the communications department here at the University of Northwestern. Good morning, Kent.
Good morning.
Okay, let's add another reason to be nervous about flying. This is crazy. A passenger is dead after getting sucked out of an airplane window on a flight from New York to Dallas. The plane made an emergency landing in Philly Tuesday after one of the jet's engines exploded just 20 minutes into the flight. They're talking, and they say they're calling it metal fatigue, which is a polite euphemism for old jets.
Well, yeah, no, and this has happened before where somebody got sucked out of the plane. There was just a couple of years ago on a Southwest flight where part of the roof came, you know, peeled back, and people could see the air or see the sky from inside the plane. No, nobody got sucked out of that one, but imagine how
just
scary
horrific.
That might
yeah.
be.
Yeah.
Now, the airlines have just, I don't know, they have a lot of bad PR, and sometimes it's brought on their own. You know, sometimes it's things like this maintenance issue. Sometimes it's this treating people poorly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these people who got left in Mexico because of the snowstorm we had this past week, and this was by Sun Country. This was totally a self-inflicted wound in terms of public relations from that airline.
And, that was. But I guess the engine exploded, and a piece of shrapnel from the exploded engine struck the window and broke it. So I was trying to think, what happens? How does a window just blow out?
Yeah, I know.
Makes me nervous. Anyway.
Me too.
Let's talk a little bit about the Supreme Court latest decision that Justice Neil Gorsuch sort of leaned with the liberal side of the bench.
Yeah, and we shouldn't – I mean, We don't want to like clump him in with the liberals and say he's one of them, and we're shocked that he's one of them. He's probably taken the same position as Antonin Scalia, his predecessor, would have taken,
mm-hmm.
in that Scalia, now Gorsuch, are opposed to ambiguous laws, and that's what it comes down to. So if legislation is ambiguous, they're going to oppose it, and so while the liberals might have on the court may have opposed it for its content, for the ideology behind the law, Gorsuch, as his predecessor Scalia, are opposing it not because of the content or the substance of it, but because of the vagueness. And so I think we should appreciate that he's really holding the legislative branch to a high standard of having precise language in the laws.
Well, there was a case with a person who was in the country illegally, and there were a couple of burglaries.
Right.
And they said, well, we should deport him instantly because of his violent behavior. And I think Gorsuch was saying, well, I don't know if we can determine that was violent behavior.
Right. And, of course, this issue, because it deals with an immigrant, of course,
mm-hmm.
it's particularly ripe at this time.
Yeah, think?
Well, but what's interesting is that they heard the arguments on this in the last session, their last year, when there was only – when, you know, it probably would have wound up being a 4-4 tie. And so they decided to essentially table it until this session of the Supreme Court, when they knew that they would have a full complement so that they wouldn't have a tie. And I suspect that they knew – where Gorsuch was going to come down on this one,
mm-hmm.
before they started hearing it again. I think they knew kind of where he was going to come down on this, and I think it's probably a good decision.
Was it the media that made it look like that President Trump was handed, just has got his head handed to him on this one?
Well, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, because it does look like a loss for the administration, but really, it's interesting because, in a sense, it's a loss for the administration because they were enforcing the law as it was written,
mm-hmm.
vaguely. Okay. So, unfortunately, it should have been the Congress that was taken to task, or the legislative process taken to task. But because it's the executive branch that's executing the law, they're the ones who looks like they got it handed to them.
So the key word in this story would be vaguely.
I think so.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's talk about millennials. I found this statistic interesting. A poll was taken. Two-thirds of millennials don't know what Auschwitz was.
Yeah, and it's more than just them to blame here. I mean, it's... They're going to school, and what are they learning? That's the question you've got to mm-hmm. ask. And if the content of their history courses doesn't include the Holocaust,
mm-hmm.
then what is in there? Like, yeah, I understand, history marches on, and, there's 50 more years of history, and, from when I was born, for example. But what could possibly be so big that it would displace the Holocaust in any history curriculum? And you could understand if it was one school or something, where one teacher or something who maybe glossed over it didn't teach that. But how could two-thirds of a generation of young people not know Auschwitz? It's mind-boggling in a way. But the other thing is, it does show you, too, in a way, I suppose, lack of curiosity of that generation for studying history even on their own. I mean, it's hard to believe that much of that generation wouldn't have had an interest in picking up the Diary of Anne Frank or mm-hmm. other books and then become interested in that episode in world history. But I think we do have a generation that doesn't particularly like to read in the first place, but isn't maybe as inquisitive or curious as maybe some previous generations about learning about big events in history. And I remember, when I was young, I still have an interest in, maybe I'm different from most people, but I really always had an interest in Western history, and I loved reading about the fur trade and reading about the West. And I think a lot of young people did. Remember back in the day, there were so many books about the West, the cowboys and Indians and the, and the explorers and the, and so on and so forth. And some of it was real, diaries of those folks. And I don't know if we quite have the same, if we're sort of passing down that appreciation for reading and for especially reading history that maybe was passed down to us.
The survey said that 22% of millennials had not heard of the Holocaust, and 41% of millennials thought 2 million or fewer Jews were murdered during the Holocaust. So even if there 41% of millennials thought there were 2 million or fewer Jews murdered, I would think that would spur people to want to learn more about it.
Right.
And
well, and I saw someone doing interviews on the street, and how those interviews on the street, can
They're
make
amazing.
People look really dumb. But but they were showing pictures of Hitler, and people couldn't even identify Hitler by the picture, which seemed stunning to me. I don't really know what to say about it because it just seems like I do question what is in the history curriculum at the elementary school level, even high school level, for sure, that people wouldn't know about that. I mean, World War II, and I don't understand. I don't get it. Mm-hmm. I just think of, there have been so many movies in pop culture. You would think that young people would be going to see those. So it makes you kind of question, what are the movie choices, or what are parents sort of telling their kids, hey, you should see this movie, or what are they taking their kids to see if they're not learning about the Holocaust? Seems to me there have been enough movies about World War II in recent years that millennials would have gotten some taste of what was going on and wondered why were we fighting. I mean, if you went to see Dunkirk,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't have seen the Holocaust, but you would have maybe wanted to inquire further, why were we fighting this war? you know, and then another, you know, if you went to see, you know, the Churchill movie that was out, you'd wonder what are we fighting the Germans for? You know, I mean, you would think, but I guess I didn't really look around in the movie theater to see who were the people surrounding me when I went to see those. I guess there probably weren't as many young people as there perhaps should have been.
Well, maybe at least who's the guy with the one-of-a-kind mustache?
Right. Well, right.
Have you ever seen that mustache before?
Well, you saw it before. But
okay,
you didn't
but never
see
again,
it after, right?
Right. Yeah. So who's that guy?
You don't really see people given that name after that either. Right?
No, you don't. So. All right, Kent. Let me take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Kent Kaiser. It's 15 minutes till the top of the hour. Minutes till the top of the hour. It seems like no matter what you're looking for in life, it's usually fallen to the bottom of your gym bag or your briefcase or your purse, or maybe it's slipped between that crack between the seat of your car and the console. So then when you try to get it out with your hand, you know how much that hurts, and then you realize you've taken off all the hair on your hand trying to get it. That happened to me yesterday. So there's my problems, Kent.
Right.
Not very sympathetic, are you? I'm looking for a little sympathy this morning, right. And what do I get from you?
Poor Bill.
Squat. Nothing. All right, let's talk about Paul Ryan and his leadership. What do we think about his job and what he's done and his exit strategy?
Well, I think he's done a decent job before he was Speaker. I don't know about while he was Speaker. I think that he represents a sort of a Republican of the past at this point. I mean, because he is leaving now, but you know, there was this era of Republicans who were led by sort of Jack Kemp, the congressman, he was a presidential candidate and so on. But he was known for his philosophy of trying to uplift everyone, the poor, and particularly was interested in kind of rolling up the sleeves to do what you needed to do to help impoverished areas, urban areas, mm-hmm. particularly. And Paul Ryan was cut from that cloth, I think. Like I think many Republicans were in the, I'd say the 1980s, especially 1990s, even. We don't see that quite as much. So much emphasis on, I think helping the poor and getting into the urban areas and things like this. Now it just happens that with what President Trump has instituted, that we have the lowest black unemployment rate, I think, pretty much on record now at this point, and poor people are doing well, and urban areas are doing well because of the booming economy. But I think that back in Jack Kemp's time, and then, you know, that was passed down to Paul Ryan and other young Republicans, I think that back then there was a really concerted sort of pointed effort for that. And I think that Paul Ryan has always been interested in entitlement reform, like reforming welfare and Social Security and Medicare and things. And President Trump has said he doesn't really have an interest in messing with those programs. And I suppose if you're Paul Ryan, you're kind of sitting there saying, well, if I'm not going to get this done, then maybe there's a different way, you know, get out of politics, get out of Congress, and maybe there's some way. I could very much see Paul Ryan being interested in going at this point to maybe more of a think tank or some kind of an activist organization like that, promoting these kinds of ideals of helping the poor and that. And then he's so young, like even if he were to run for president in 2028, he'd still be younger than President Trump by a long way.
Yeah.
And so I think that maybe he's kind of trying to separate himself from this particular administration and this kind of newer brand of Republicanism so that he can come back at a future date. I think he's not been the strongest leader. I mean, I think that in the Congress, we did get this nice tax cut passed. But, you know, if you have an agenda that says, you know, roll back Obamacare and you can't get that done, and fix the immigration system and you can't get that done, even though you've got a Republican House, a Republican Senate, a Republican president, that doesn't exactly say that you've got a strong leadership going on there.
Mm-hmm. The last former Speaker, John Boehner, is now advocating for deregulation of marijuana.
Right. It's interesting because he spent his whole career fighting this very it's mind-boggling, actually. But I suppose, you know, he's being paid or something to now be on the opposite side of this issue that he was, you know, on, you know, in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. Who might be the next speaker?
Well, I think people are looking like Kevin McCarthy from California, who would probably be a little bit more aggressive. I think what you need to have in a speaker is somebody who can who people fear in a way. Like, you know, and when, like, John Boehner was the speaker, and what you need is, you know, if the guy says, "Well, I need you to vote this way," that people will vote that way. We've got that in the Senate. You know, people, you know, in a way fear Mitch McConnell in the Senate. You know, Mitch McConnell kind of knows how to count noses. He knows when he's got the votes and when he doesn't, and when he can push stuff forward. And you never got the sense that Paul Ryan really had a handle on his caucus, and he does. And it was a more wieldy, you know, unwieldy, I should say, caucus with people in different factions and stuff. But, you know, in a leader, what you need is somebody who can bring them all together, whether it's by fear or whatever, fear of not being helped in the next election. That's what everybody's usually worried about is, am I going to have the backing of my party? Am I going to have support of my leader for the campaign and things like this? And you never got the sense that people were afraid that Paul Ryan wasn't going to show up for them.
Yeah.
And even when he was talking about President Trump, he's kind of all over the map. He wasn't with him, but then once he got elected, he was with him. And so you didn't get a sense that he was a very strong leader in that sense. I like the guy. I mean, I think that his ideas are good, but not the strongest leader.
Kent, what do you think about when somebody says something on television and then the next thing that happens is the boycotting of advertisers?
Well, boycotts don't usually work in the long run. I mean, we talk about this in public relations classes all the time. You know, there's a boycott right now, for example, with Nestle, and it's existed for like 40 years because of their practices of selling infant formula in Africa. Does anybody even know this? No.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible to keep it. I think it's impossible to keep a boycott going for long. And so that's one thing to notice. And I think that as soon as one advertiser leaves because of some comment, some other is going to come in and pretty quickly, I think, because you can't sort of erase overnight the popularity of somebody who's on television or radio. And I think that every once in a while there'll be somebody who's done something so awful, but just a couple of comments, no, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
What do you think about what went on in the Starbucks in Philadelphia where they had an arrest, and now Starbucks is going to shut down 8,000 stores?
Yeah, this is kind of crazy. I think that people should take a step back and look, like, this is one Starbucks. You know, I think people will realize this. I think it'll happen very quickly. People are going to realize, like, they still want their, you know, their overpriced cup of coffee that always tastes a little burnt. Mm-hmm. You know, and they're going to go back to Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll recognize it was one incident. And that's the thing is, you know, people want to boycott. Is going back to the airlines. People want to boycott this or that airline because for one incident. It's very difficult to continue a boycott because at some point that's the airline you need to use, or
right.
Starbucks has the product that you want to buy.
Right.
And so I just think that boycotts are, I think they're a dumb idea because they just it's very difficult to get them to last for for very long.
Now you've obviously stopped at a fast food restaurant because you've urgently needed to go to the bathroom. And well, why can you do that at like the Golden Arches, but you can't stop and do that at a Starbucks?
Right. It is crazy. But I mean, again, it comes down to one story. We actually have a law about this in Minnesota. There is a law about this, emergency bathroom law.
Like, what is it?
Well, if you are having a bathroom emergency and you go into a store and they have a bathroom, they need to let you use it.
Oh,
I mean, even if it's typically just for their employees or something like that. So it could be any store if they've got a bathroom.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what about...
Which was sparked by a similar incident, by the way.
Was it really?
Like somebody was told, I can't use the bathroom.
Yeah. Now, getting back to the airlines, what about what's going on with emotional support animals?
It's crazy. Emotional support. Peacock wasn't allowed. I think that's fine. I don't understand. Like, if you need emotional support on an airplane, it might be better to think about a different means of travel, actually. I mean, honestly,
much of suckers are airlines? If you have to have a service animal, okay, that's legitimate. You're a vet or something, and you've got or you're blind or something, you have got a service animal. But now all of a sudden, isn't it just easier and cheaper just to say, I have my dog, I want to travel, I don't want to put it in luggage and pay for the shipping, and I don't want to board it while I travel, so I'll just take it with me. And all of a sudden, now you've got an emotional support animal.
Well, and it could be that somebody else has an allergy to it and stuff. It's a mess. I think that the airlines should put their foot down. And, you know, I think the airlines could have more rules, and it would make it a more pleasant experience for most travelers, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, you're allowed to bring your support animal in the studio anytime you like, Kent.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever that might be. I'm open to it. Kent, thanks so much for being on the show today. It's 4 minutes till the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and wrap up hour one.
Gray skies are gonna clear up, put on a happy face.
We're back. We're back. I still have Dr. Ken Kaiser in studio. Ken, I wanted to get your parting thoughts on Mrs. Bush.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, I'm of the generation that grew up with Reagan and Bush. And, you know, I think I came of age during their time in office. And so I think a lot of us are probably in mourning today, you know, for Mrs. Bush. Because, I mean, she was a prominent figure, having been both the wife of a president and the mother of another president. And it's... She's the second one in history. The other one was Abigail Adams way back in the beginning of our country. But you know, I think Barbara Bush was, you know, this very strong force in the White House, and we didn't even recognize it. You know, she would be the one who would be the bad guy, in a way, the bad cop. If mm-hmm. somebody, she would protect her husband, she would protect her sons. And she would be the one who would send a speech back, improved, you know, with edits. And she was about literacy, and I think that's something that, you know, we can all very much appreciate.
Yeah. All right, Kent, thank you so much. Hour two is up next. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend, and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.